Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Joe Biden has broken the record for the most votes ever received by a presidential candidate, more than 78.8 million and counting. He now leads the popular vote by more than 5.8 million. But many are still wondering, how did Donald Trump manage to get more than 73 million votes? He got even more votes this time than he did in 2016. What does this tell us about the state of the country? What does this mean for the future? And one more important question, can the Biden administration deliver for the people, or will some form of Trumpism return in 2024? Today's guest, Thomas Frank, has been writing about the Democratic Party's shift from the working class and labor to Wall Street and neoliberalism for decades. In his latest book, The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism, Thomas Frank says Democrats need to get back to being a party that creates real change for the people. And the people clearly want real change. Even recent Fox News polling indicates voters want universal health care and a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. A number of polls over the years show that more than 75% of adults in the U.S. support Roe v. Wade. In Florida, voters passed a measure to increase the state's minimum wage to $15 an hour, and it was over 60%. So today we are going to talk about where we are right now and what it will take to ensure that the Biden administration actually produces. Thomas Frank is a political analyst, historian, and author of many books, including Listen Liberal or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Thomas Frank is founder of the Baffler magazine. Hi, Thomas. Welcome back to the show. It's great to have you.
Rose, it's nice to be here. Although I wish I was there in person like in the old days.
I know, I do too. You know, I've been thinking about your books, like What's the Matter with Kansas, Listen Liberal, and this one. And I just wonder how you're thinking about where we are right now, because life is so different than when you wrote Listen Liberal. And I'm sorry, What's the Matter with Kansas? And I'm really thinking about the media landscape. It's not just Fox News anymore. It's like people still don't believe that COVID is real. So, yeah. So much has changed since you wrote that book. And I'm just wondering, you know, what's going through your mind right now?
That it's all like everything that I described in that book has become so, you know, it's now on such a massive scale. It's yeah. Everywhere. I mean, we're all basically all living in Kansas now. I guess I should take some kind of satisfaction from that, but I don't. You know, it's not a happy time. But look, there's a lot of relief that Biden was able to. Biden was able to pull it off and defeat Donald Trump. I had a lot of doubts about his ability to do that.
I think
COVID gave it to him. I think COVID, right. Sorry, that's a bad metaphor there, but I think mm-hmm. COVID is what made his victory possible. My opinion is that Biden is a lackluster candidate with not a whole lot going for him other than his winning personality. You know, and that, you know, that's a good thing, right? People don't hate him. You know, he's kind of a lovable guy. But up until COVID, remember, the economy was roaring. And that was a recipe for Donald Trump getting reelected, no matter, you know, it doesn't matter what a jerk he is. It's funny, Rose, you can't see this, but in the background, they always know when I'm on the radio. And as soon as I went on with you, my phone started ringing. I don't know how the hell they know that. But like every interview I've done for the last couple weeks, as soon as I go on the air, the phone starts ringing. Anyhow, sorry. It's just one of those weird little COVID things, you know, sitting here in the house.
Well, you know, and the other thing, Thomas, I mean, if we think about all of the forces at play here, you know, you do such a great job of looking at the history of the Democratic Party and why the party shifted from, in simple terms, from the working class to neoliberalism. Okay, yeah. And then you've got massive voter suppression, which really hits poor people and communities of color the hardest. And then we have gerrymandering. So in many states, Democrats get more votes, but Republicans win their elections, especially at the state level.
And vice versa, by the way. There's some hilarious Democratic gerrymandering here in Maryland, where I am right now.
Oh, really?
Where they basically redrew the map to put a single billionaire in a in a congressional district. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you've got the gerrymandering. And of course, liberals do it, but conservatives could do it at a much higher rate.
Yeah, with much more consequences. Yeah.
Right. Yep. And then you have the changing media landscape. I think this is what's been keeping me up at night, is hearing these nurses say that they are treating people who are on the verge of dying. And they're basically screaming, I still do not believe in COVID. This is fake news. So yeah, there's all these different forces.
Isn't that just incredible? And it's I wrestle with this myself all the time, because what you're describing is the destruction of local news, of newspapers, right, of journalism as a whole. I mean, this is a country of 300 million people, more, 325, mm-hmm, whatever it is, and we have basically three newspapers that matter. Two, because the Wall Street Journal has that paywall that you can't get around. And so it's basically two newspapers that's the source. And then the TV news takes all their, all their marching orders from those two newspapers, the Washington Post and the New York Times. And this is for an enormous country. And I go to towns all the time where the newspaper has died. I spent a lot of time in my hometown of Kansas City, which once had one of the great regional newspapers in America. And today it's just a shadow of its former self. The news section will be about 8 pages long. Fortunately, the sports section is still pretty robust. But no, this is happening everywhere. And it's simultaneously we're coming together. Everybody's on social media. It's easier to find people than ever before. And at the same time, just falling to pieces in terms of how we talk to each other, how we think about things. Yeah, it's amazing. And I hate being right about this. I hate it.
Well, and so how do we – there's so much to talk with you about. How do we deal with this? Because I was watching CNN was going to one of these Don't Let Biden Steal the Vote rallies. And there were these Trump supporters there, and they showed him a video of these ballots that were burned on the ground. And the reporter said, well, that's been debunked by election officials. Those ballots were not Trump-Biden ballots. And there's this woman that said, well, I don't believe election officials. And he said, well, then who do you believe? And she said, you have to question everything. And so if you can't agree on a set of actual facts, how do we get out of this?
Well, it's tough. Look, I feel the same way myself very often these days. And I'm not a conservative, I'm not a Trump supporter, and I'm not a believer in conspiracy theory. And by the way, just so you know, conspiracy theories, one of the reasons that they're attractive is that they're fun. They're flattering. They push our psychological buttons in all sorts of ways. And people like to believe in conspiracy theories. There's a long history of this in American life. It goes way, way, way back. But I have to say that I feel the same way myself when I try. I wrote this book about the Democratic Party, Listen Liberal, and the new one also, The People Know. A big part of it is about the Democratic Party. And there's this sense that just here in the last 4 years, I'm one of these people that used to deny that the media was particularly liberal. I used to talk about this all the time, and I'd say no, they don't really have a well thought out politics, that sort of thing. But they have openly become a partisan in the last 4 years. I mean, openly, nakedly, they don't try to hide it. They talk about it all the time. And, they have CIA officials. They are obviously starting to understand themselves using a kind of propaganda model. And this is, first of all, a recipe for destroying public confidence in you. And second of all, it's not a for someone like me, it makes it very difficult to try to figure out exactly what is going on in the world. Now, I think I'm better prepared than most people because, read books. I go to the library all the time. You know, there's lots of other sources out there in the world that I happen to know about, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But your average American doesn't have access to those things. Their local newspaper is dead. What do they have? They have, you know, these kind of nutty but fun conspiracy theories, this idea that everybody can figure everything out all by themselves. You know, it's a priesthood of all believers. We're all experts. I'm sorry, Rose. I don't want to go too far down this road, because I think at the end of the day, we do want people. People have to be well informed, because ultimately this is a democracy. Those people are who, you know, decides the future for us.
Right. Yeah, I think it's something that we're going to have to really tackle from here on out, because
I also want to warn you, because this is also there's a dangerous side to this. I mean, you and I agree on this, that we're in a very difficult, tricky, unpleasant situation. But there's this temptation, and this is what seems even more dangerous to me. There's this temptation in American life. This is what I call anti-populism. You know, this is the sort of the subject of this new book of mine, this idea that everything has to be turned over to experts and technocrats and sort of people with advanced degrees in Washington, D.C. And they can figure everything out. And we just, you know, that the ideal solution to all of these problems is to basically take matters out of the hands of ordinary people. And I think that's much more dangerous. Then, I mean, we're in a very bad situation that you described very well, but I think that that's the tendency that you see here in Washington, D.C., is just to basically give up on the idea of democracy altogether. And that's, I think, even more dangerous.
Mm. Well, and so to flip it and talk about something much more
positive. Yeah, let's talk about something happy. Yes.
Yeah, much more positive and hopeful. But that's the one thing I thought, why am I not feeling as kind of relieved and breathing like I thought I would for a few days after the election? And I think it's because of what I'm seeing, hearing people say that they don't believe in COVID and so much more. But on a positive note, we've been doing so many shows about Latinos, Black voters. Tomorrow we're talking, or Thursday, we're talking about the Native vote. So many young people getting out to vote during COVID, organizing and really turning out in huge numbers for the Democratic Party. And in some cases, they weren't that excited, but they understood what was at stake.
Yep. I think that's a great thing. And let's hope that that keeps going. Okay. That those people stay interested and stay involved, because in my opinion, look, I gave up any hope in the Republican Party a long time ago. Maybe that was a mistake, but that's what I did. And so if you ask me, whatever solutions, and I guess I'm tipping my partisan hand here, but whatever solutions are going to come to us are going to have to come, I think, via the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party is not exactly a really healthy, bearer of those solutions right now. So it's very important that those young people stay involved and keep an eagle eye on what's going on. And also I feel sometimes, Rose, and I've been coming on your show for a long time, I feel like I was a little too innocent at some point, and I really believed in, well, Barack Obama. I thought that he was a great man. And when he came in as president in 2009, I thought he was exactly the right person for the job. And he had this extraordinary mandate, and he had the world at his back. And I thought he was going to do the right thing. And he wound up being a huge disappointment, and in some ways made Trumpism possible, I think. I think Bill Clinton helped a lot in that regard as well. This is a long story of disappointment by the Democratic Party. But in my opinion, they have this generation of Democratic leaders basically paved the road for Donald Trump. And it is absolutely essential that we figure out what they did wrong so that we can avoid it in the future, because Trumpism is not ending, you know, with this guy going down with Donald Trump losing this election.
Right. And of course, racism played a massive role, which we'll talk about a little later in the show. I've heard you in interviews say that you believe, of course, Biden, the first thing he needs to do is deal with COVID. and ensure that some kind of relief package is passed ASAP. I was just watching a video of the North Texas Food Bank, and on Saturday, they served 50,000 people. I mean, the cars were lining up for hours. People are really hurting right now. Evictions are going to come in massive numbers in January.
Yeah, and he's got to swing into action in a huge way.
I mean, that was 25,000 people. I want to get that right, but huge, 25,000 people in one day.
Extraordinary.
Got food.
It's like Great Depression style numbers, and it's really alarming. And yes, he's got to swing into action immediately. And the other thing is that, you know, there's all of these governors now talking about doing another lockdown, you know, because the numbers of the disease are spiking. They're out of control. It's everywhere. And you can't do that if you're not going to, you know, this is a country, we don't have any system in place for providing for people. You're going to put all of their businesses out of business. You know, all of these small businesses, all of these restaurants, et cetera, are all going to go under. There's going to be enormous unemployment. All sorts of people are going to lose their health care. They're going to lose their income. They're going to lose, you know, any ability to pay their bills. And we've got no system in place for dealing with that. You know, this is it's verging on catastrophe is what it is. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, Biden has to deal with that energetically. That's the first order of business. But I think the second order of business, and that, you know, something that's going to take a little more thought, is preventing a resurgence of Trumpism, a second wave of Trumpism. You know, he's got to head that off at the pass.
So let's talk more about what that means exactly, because even with COVID, even with so many people suffering, even with all of the racist, xenophobic remarks he made, the separation of children, on and on and on, he got more than 73 million votes. So when you think about the Democrats really taking on Trumpism, what does that mean to you?
That means figuring out what made it possible and what they can do to the Democratic Party can do to prevent a recurrence of that. And that does mean looking in the mirror. I mean, obviously they can't control what the Republican Party is going to do next. And I can absolutely tell you with a lot of certainty what the Republican Party is going to do next.
Well, can we talk about that? Because I'm wondering if Biden
going to continue down this road. The Republicans first. They're going to continue down this road. There's going to be another Trump. Whether it's he himself, you know, doing a kind of Grover Cleveland thing and running for getting a second non-consecutive term, or whether it's somebody else, one of his kids or Ted Cruz. I mean, there's all of these senators who are already showing interest in the 2024 race. The thing is this, they're never going to back off of Trumpism. Trumpism delivered to them all of these Rust Belt states, so Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, that they never had a chance of getting before. And so they've suddenly glimpsed something. You know, for years, the Republican Party assumed that they were dying and they were going to be a permanent minority party. And the you know, the Democrats said this as well. This is the famous sort of demographic theory of American politics. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden they've discovered a way out of that trap, and they're never going to give up on that way out. And that is to become, as Trump and Bannon, Steve Bannon, his advisor, said so many times, to become a workers' party. Now they say this with total cynicism, Rose. They don't actually intend to, you know, to do a whole lot for working class people. But this is the direction that the Republican Party has been going in for a long time, and it's going to continue down that road. And so all of the things that are, I think, objectionable about Trumpism are going to be, with a few exceptions, all of those things are going to be ramped up. And unless I am completely wrong, I think that Trump's bigotry was, you know, this actually made him weaker, not stronger. And I think the next Trump will be smarter than that. I mean, look, when Trump remember when he first announced that he was running for president, he said that Mexicans were, what was it, rapists and murderers?
Right.
It's like, what kind of politician says something like that? That's just incredibly stupid politically, not to mention wrong and defamatory. It's on and on and on. It's and he does things like that all the time. Insult, like gratuitously insulting handicapped people. Like, what kind of idiot does that? And so what I'm saying is the next Trump won't be quite so stupid. He also was a lousy president. I mean, let's just give him credit where it's due. This guy had no idea how to be president. He had it pretty easy his first 3 years, but then finally he gets a crisis, you know, the pandemic, and he bungles it in the most incredible way. I mean, this man clearly has no business, sitting in the Oval Office. And all I'm saying to you is that the next Trump won't be so bad at the game.
And the next Trump will actually be interested in governing. I mean, the next
right.
Trump.
To make this really brief, you know, we talk about Trump's authoritarianism. And I think maybe he feels that way in his heart of hearts. But given the absolute perfect opportunity to come in and crack down and grab complete control of the country, which is COVID, that was his opportunity. He didn't do it. He did everything he could to keep the economy open and to like tell people that it wasn't that there was nothing to worry about and you don't even have to wear masks and on and on. All of the silly things that he did the opposite. And the next Trump won't be that stupid.
And yet he still got more than 73 million votes.
Yes. Isn't that fascinating?
It is. And I also just want to also add to this that people of color who did not vote for Trump, because many did, but for those who didn't, this is really, really difficult to take, given the racism, what he said about Mexicans, on and on and on. And yet he still managed to get more than 73 million votes.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And I'm old enough so that in my lifetime, I've seen a number of failed presidencies. And I would count Trump's as a failed presidency. I mean, there's no other way to describe the disaster of the last year. But I saw, Jimmy Carter was a failed, Richard Nixon, certainly, George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr., all of them. And in all of those cases, their numbers, their approval ratings fell apart at the end, were way, way, way lower than Donald Trump's. He managed to hang on to his core group of supporters in a kind of extraordinary way that, I mean, you could see it coming. I don't want to say it surprised me. But this shows you that there is life in this movement yet.
And there are all many, many layers to all of this. I mean, there's no simple answer to these questions. And you look at, when you say that the presidency was a disaster, you also have to think about how successful it was with three Supreme Court justices, so many judges at the appeals court level. I mean, more judges than we've seen in decades. A massive tax cut for corporations and the wealthy. Major deregulation across the board, especially for the planet. I mean, the list just goes on and on.
Yep. Polluters did great. Yes. That's right. I don't consider those things a great success, though, especially when we talk about the kind of the people that voted for Donald Trump. He obviously has this core group of supporters among the very wealthy. That's the Republican Party, of course. What people refer to as his base, the sort of white working class supporters, none of those things were particularly good for them. Although he did, he managed to deliver a roaring economy right up until COVID shut it all down. But I don't really give him all the credit for that. I think that's, he inherited that economy from Obama and Janet Yellen and et cetera. And so I'm not going to say that was It all ended in disaster. What I'm saying is that other presidents whose terms ended in disaster saw the public repudiate them. And that didn't happen this time.
Right. And by success, it's you wonder why people stick with him, especially, hardcore longtime conservatives, the judges, the anti-abortion policies, the tax cuts.
Yeah, well, those are all things that they've wanted to do for a long time and that they've been doing. I mean, this is all – we were talking about what's the matter with Kansas earlier. This is exactly the playbook. You know, it's all about the culture wars in public. And is it ever about the culture wars these days? Mm-hmm. And then they go to do their governing in Washington, D.C. And what do they deliver? Of course, tax cuts and deregulation. And Trump did deliver on those terms in a kind of fantastic way.
Right. We're going to take a quick break.
Spectacular way. Yeah.
We're joined by Thomas Frank, a historian and author of many books. His latest is The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism. There's so much to talk about here. Luckily, we have an hour so we can go over all of these issues. What are you thinking right now when you look at these numbers that Biden has over 78 million votes? Trump got more than 73 million votes. That's more than he got in 2016. How are you thinking about these issues? Just where we are in this country with a lot of people, you know, who say I'm leaving Fox News for something that's even more to the right, or I'm leaving Twitter to go to a conservative type Twitter. What are you thinking right now about these issues? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are speaking with Thomas Frank, historian and author of many best-selling books. His latest is The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism. Thomas Frank says Democrats need to get back to being a party that creates real change for the people, or we could get someone worse than Trump in 2024. So how are you thinking about these issues? If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. What do you expect from the Biden administration based on what you're hearing from them and some of the people they're planning to appoint? What are your expectations? Let's hear from Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil. Thanks for holding.
Hi, Rose. Dr. Frank, I'm a huge fan. I'd like you to put your historian hat on. And I'm thinking, we know that Trump loves rallies. He, as a matter of fact, in 2017, he shocked people by continuing his rallies, even though he had been inaugurated. What if we have a scenario where Trump, starting, let's say, as early as February and then continuing for the 4 years, has rallies, his little, well, you can call them mini Nurembergs, if you like. And what, with the social media age that we live in, with et cetera, what, I'm thinking about 1824 when Andrew Jackson felt he was cheated and he hated John Quincy Adams. And you mentioned Grover Cleveland and Benjamin Harrison. And then lastly, Teddy Roosevelt, when he turned against Taft. What do those episodes inform us about this sort of nightmare, you know, scenario that I'm conjuring of a 4-year campaign with Trump? And especially if, you know, you have Trump seizing on every small or maybe big reversal that the Biden administration suffers in the next 4 years, as undoubtedly it will. How would you see that unfolding?
I love that question. But basically you just described it. I mean, that is how it would unfold. I mean, you can't, if Trump wants to have rallies, you can't stop him. You know, and he will go on, and his, you know, he's already posing. You know, he's doing a, by the way, one of the arguments that I've always made is that he's behaving in a typical Republican way. His language is more vulgar than previous Republicans, and he's rougher and grosser than other Republicans. But he does the same thing that they do. And his efforts to delegitimize Biden right now, you know, where he's refusing to concede and he's making all these silly claims about, you know, that he was cheated and all this. And it's, you know, he's going to file all his lawsuits and he's going to lose. And then they're going to swear Biden in, and he probably won't even come to the inauguration, and he'll be off in a huff somewhere. And it's all a pose so that he can then, you know, pose as the kind of government in exile and campaign for 4 years and or run a TV network for 4 years or do whatever it is that he does. And then either him or someone that he chooses will run against Biden 4 years from now. There's not a whole lot you can do to dissuade him from doing that. I think that's very accurate that's probably what he will do. It's clear that he loves those rallies. If you watch him, given the kind of personality that he has, he absorbs, and this is very typical of politicians too, by the way. Let's not just single out Trump for this. They love absorbing that mass adulation. You know what I'm talking about? I was watching one of his rallies earlier this year on YouTube, and the audience, Trump got the audience to start chanting, "We love you." and then they did, right? And then he told them to do this, and they started doing it, and he pretended it was spontaneous, but you could just see him soaking this up. He loved it so much. And he really enjoys doing these things, and I think that is exactly what the caller said, is exactly right. He will continue, and he will pose as a rightful government in exile, and he'll challenge Biden again 4 years from now. He's clearly his power in the Republican Party has not been dimmed by his defeat.
Well, thank you for calling in, Phil. Let's go to our next caller, Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Rose. I think that journalists and authors and such folks understand issues in great detail and
there it went. But well, you know, Rose, that reminded me that we haven't got to what Biden could do to stave off Trump 2.0.
Yes.
You know, this is what I'm going around the country proselytizing about. I should probably have mentioned it, you know.
Yeah, no, let's talk about that. And I think, Mark, we lost him, but I think he wanted to say, if I'm correct, some people don't vote for issues. They vote like it's a sporting event.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And not only that, they don't pay attention to issues, or they're able to brush issues off and think about things in a much more in a more emotional, a sentimental way. Does this politician make me feel good? Does this TV show insult me? And we're living in a time, one of the reasons that we're living in a time of such incredible polarization is the subject that we began with, because of the changes in the media. One of the sort of really remarkable phenomena of the last couple of years, as I mentioned earlier, has been the sort of self-radicalization of CNN, MSNBC. I mean, radicalization in quotation marks, of course. But they if you turn them on now, they look and sound like The Nation magazine back in the 1980s, you know, or something like that. And this has had the effect of forcing people into different camps. They've made it absolutely clear that there is not going to be any kind of, we're not going to accept people that voted for Trump back into the fold of ordinary Americans. It forces them to sort of identify further with this guy. I mean, it forces a polarization on us. I'm sorry. I'm having trouble with my vocabulary this morning. I was working on an essay when I called you up this morning and now I'm forgetting the damn word, and it's driving me crazy. But you know what the word was, Rose? It's forgiveness. That we are in this strange place in our society, you know, where we are, visibly, emphatically denying forgiveness to all of these people, making it impossible for them to sort of relinquish this bad mistake that I feel that they made in the year 2016. And this brings us back to Biden. What do you do if you want to short circuit Trump's appeal? What do you do if you want to break his hold on this group of voters? Well, the first thing you got to remember is that a lot of these people are former Democrats. I'm not talking only about the people that switched, the famous group of voters that switched from Obama to Trump here. I'm talking about in a long-term historical sense the idea that some section of the working class would become, enthusiastic about a guy like Donald Trump would have been unthinkable, say 40 or 50 years ago. It would have been really, really strange. And the Democrats made that possible by, you know, with their famous move to the center in the 80s and the 1990s, although, you know, it's not really the center, it's really the right. This is the famous the New Democrats, also known as the Third Way, also known as neoliberals. But basically, they decided in those days that they didn't want to be the party of organized labor anymore. They didn't really want to represent working class, you know, the concerns of working class people. They were going to be a party that believed in that had a different constituent group. And we, you and I have talked about this before, Rose, but they were going to look out for that. They were going to pay attention to what they called the learning class, what in San Francisco, I believe, is called the creative class. Mm-hmm. They have all of these wonderful terms for these people, and they do all sorts of amazing favors for them. And you're in this situation now, Rose, where you take an institution like Wall Street, you know, big finance, right? When I was a kid, there was no more Republican industry than Wall Street. But today they overwhelmingly give to the Democratic candidate. Silicon Valley, same story. When I started out in journalism, I used to make fun of all of the Silicon Valley libertarianism. Do you remember George Gilder would write these books about how the microchip embodied libertarian values? Well, they give to Democrats now. Or you look at the wealthiest counties in this country, Orange County in California, all these wealthy suburban counties that have flipped to the Democratic Party. The county I grew up in, Johnson County, Kansas, is an affluent suburb of Kansas City, white collar, professional class. When I was a kid, these were some of the most Republican people in America. You know, I grew up there. This is Bob Dole country. This is Nancy Kassebaum country. They just went for Joe Biden, first Democrat they voted for since Woodrow Wilson. But this is happening everywhere. And when you're that party, and Democrats are, they regard this, by the way, as a great success. Look what they did. Joe Biden won while getting the, you know, lavish, he outraised Donald Trump massively. He is the toast of all of the sort of growing industries in America. But at the same time, Democrats have lost this huge population of people who are left out, of people who are being left behind, of people in the deindustrialized zones. Now, I know you know this story. You've thought about this a million times. You've read it about it in the paper. We've all thought about this. But just think about it right now in larger historical terms. What kind of left party, you know, loses the votes of people who are on their way down? Mm. That's crazy in historical terms. And once we get our minds around that, and by the way, this is the whole story of my career, is reminding people of this, how crazy this situation is that we're in today. And once you get your mind around that, you can start to see the way out of this. It's that the Democrats have to somehow recover some element of, you know, of being a traditional party of the left. You know, they have to, you know, sort of, they have to get back together with organized labor. They have to understand the concerns of working people. You know, I just saw an interview the other day with Rahm Emanuel, who's one of the sort of leading figures behind this sort of great Democratic move to the right, you know, the New Democrats and all that. Mayor of Chicago there for a couple of years. And Rahm Emanuel was talking about these industries, these dying industries in America, and he said, those jobs aren't coming back. And he's saying this right now in the year 2020, those jobs aren't coming back. And it just, when I saw that, and Democrats have been saying this since forever. Remember, Bill Clinton used to say things like that all the time. Barack Obama would say things like that all the time. And it's the dumbest thing in the world to say, because you just lost, as a politician, you just lost those people's votes. And second of all, it's not even true. There's all kinds of things that our government could do to make, you know, to make those people who are losing everything, to make them parts of the middle class society again. It could be done. The idea that it can't be done is ridiculous. But what did Rahm Emanuel go on to say? They all need to learn how to code. Right? That's the answer. It's always education, and the onus is always on you. It's not because they made bad decisions over the years, bad trade agreements, you know, subsidized the wrong thing, did too many favors for Silicon Valley. No. The problem is because you didn't go to the right school or you didn't study the right subject. And I am here to tell you, Rose, saying things like that is poison for the Democrats. Of course, it's rocket fuel for Trumpism. But, you know, so thing number one, stop doing stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? And we'll get to, we have a lot of people on the line. We'll get to calls in just a minute. What do you think, given that we know Joe Biden very well from his record in the Senate and as vice president, and you studied the Obama administration very, very closely, what are the major changes based on what you're hearing from Biden, based on the platform that you've read? What will be the major changes that we will see under a Biden administration?
Well, I mean, it goes in two directions. We don't know yet. Of course, it's too early to tell. The first order of business has to be another effort to get some kind of universal health care. It's going to be real. I mean, here in a pandemic, I mean, it is a flashing red light emergency now. Now it's going to be tough with Mitch McConnell in the U.S. Senate, but you know, he's got to try. And if it only means just shoring up Obamacare, you know, I'll take that. But Obamacare has really proven itself. We've seen the weaknesses in Obamacare in this pandemic, that as universal healthcare systems go, it's not a particularly good one. And it's not even a really great basis to start from. Medicare is a much better basis to start from. And by the way, that's, as you, I think you mentioned earlier in the program, that's an extremely, you know, universal healthcare remains extremely popular, as it has ever since the 1940s. That's something that's always been very popular in American life. And Biden needs to somehow get behind that. There are other things he needs to do, but I'm, as you mentioned, you know, Biden's record does not give me hope that he is going to do the right thing, or that Biden would even understand the argument that I just made in the last segment, that Biden would even understand that. Biden was a leading force behind the Democratic Party's move to the right. You think of the landmark pieces of legislation in that, the trade agreements like NAFTA and PNTR China, he was behind those. You think of the crackdown on working class people via the crime bills, or via welfare reform. That's, Biden was there. Biden was one of the was one of the co-authors of the various crime bills over the years. Directly responsible for those things. You think of the banks. You know, all the bank deregulation that we did. Well, Biden was singularly responsible for the bankruptcy reform in the Bush years, which made it impossible to discharge student loan debt in bankruptcy, among other things. It was a big favor to the credit card companies and to the banks, you know, and he's from Delaware and that's what he does. His record in those terms is really bad. However, on the other hand, there are a lot of progressives. I'm speaking to you from Washington, as you know, there are lots of progressives in this town who really think that Biden is secretly one of them. And every time I say that, I have to chuckle because it just seems so improbable. But I've been told this so many times, you know. And let's just put it this way: I hope they turn out to be right. Wouldn't that be great? If Biden was the man for the moment, but I refuse to get too excited about that after what happened last time around.
Let's take a few calls. People have been waiting patiently. Today we're speaking with Thomas Frank, a historian and author who writes about all of these issues. He's been doing this for decades, really studying the history of the Democratic Party. Let's go to Kay in San Francisco. Hi, Kay. Thank you for holding.
Hi there. I've been listening for about 45 minutes. I don't know if you're on the air that long. I'm not familiar with your work. However, I do want to state you've been speaking, you both have been, and neither one of you have mentioned the Senate or the House. And you have not mentioned Mitch McConnell or Nancy Pelosi, who have both been controlling for years now through Obama, through Trump. And we cannot discuss the governing of this country without discussing how they've been acting. Mitch McConnell at one point said that he would make Obama a one-term president. Nancy Pelosi, when we speak, you refer to people in Texas with poverty. Both leaders know, and they have a responsibility to work out an agreement, and neither one of them have, because they've been busy playing God. What can I tell you? How can you discuss the future of this country when there's no change? And one final thing before I go. The Republican vote for Donald Trump. Don't forget that there was a lot at stake in this election. And one was the Senate and the other was the House. So more Democrats went to get Trump out, but more Republicans went because they actually wanted to keep the Senate and do better in the House. So their whole motivation was not about Donald Trump. And I'll get off here, and I'm enjoying listening to. But I think you've got it. You know, you've left out a big space in here.
Well, okay. Kay, thank you for calling. It sounds like you just found the show, and we've been doing a lot of shows recently about the Senate. One thing that was really striking, Thomas, is listening to Biden and Harris, and they rarely talked about the importance of the Senate. We were very surprised by that. And we've been doing shows about what's going on in Georgia. And in order for the Dems to have a 50-50 split, they have to win both of those seats in Georgia.
Yeah, and that's going to be real difficult for them. Look, it's hard to nationalize an election if you don't have an issue. And if you go back and look at all the Democrats that were running for the presidency, you know, in the primary, Joe Biden was basically the only one on the stage that did not have some singular reform that he was emphasizing, that he was running for. It was just Joe Biden was Joe Biden, and he was running for president again. Here we go. It was running as a kind of candidate of restoration, a kind of candidate of complacency, if you will. And it's really difficult to get people motivated and to pull off a wave election if you don't have a great cause that you're running for. And Mitch McConnell, I think I actually did talk about Mitch McConnell a few minutes ago. You know, he is singularly motivated, as the Republicans are. They play this game in this extraordinary way, obstruction, 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 when they can, you know, they'll stop anything. Do you remember how they played Obama during the debate over Obamacare? It was painful to watch. Now, the good thing is that, the bad news is it looks unlikely that they're going to get that, absent a miracle, it looks unlikely that they're going to get the Senate majority. And that's going to make it very difficult for Biden to do much of anything big. But there are other ways to play it. And Biden, at least, is he's not naive. He's been there. He's been in Washington for almost 50 years. He understands how the Republicans operate. It bugs me when he talks about, how you have to reach across the aisle and come to consensus with these guys, because coming to consensus with these guys is how we got into this terrible situation that we're in as a nation right now. It's when Democrats decided that they needed to basically adopt Reaganism and start making deals with these guys on their terms. That's how this modern age began. That's how we got to Trumpism. I hope Biden can overcome that and can understand how to play these guys rather than getting played by these guys. But I'm not holding my breath.
Well,
I'm sorry. I just talked too much, Rose.
No, it's okay. It's okay. Kay, thank you for calling. And I hope you tune in again. We are going to do an entire show about Mitch McConnell, given that he did win re-election. And Anthony wrote, "I don't think we can understand Trump's presidency without recognizing Mitch McConnell's bland ruthlessness in pursuing the Koch brothers' agenda." We're almost out of time, Thomas, but Kay also...
You know, the Koch brothers they've changed their agenda. There's one Koch brother left, and he now says he's sorry, so...
Well,
isn't that funny?
Still,
it's like the entire ruling class of this country has turned on the Republicans in this shocking way. And this is one of the things that makes Donald Trump's support so resilient, is that the perception that he is surrounded by unfair persecutors.
Mm. Well, we're definitely going to do a show about Mitch McConnell, Kay, and the Senate. To Kay's question about the House, according to the latest numbers, Republicans gained 8 seats in the House, a number of anti-choice women Republicans won those races. And we're almost out of time, Thomas, but I just wonder what your thoughts are about the debate that's the Democrats are having between the sort of moderate wing versus the progressive wing. You know, the progressives are being slammed for, you know, the defund the police, abolish ICE. And then progressives are saying you need to be bold and stand for things like Medicare for all. What are your thoughts about that conversation?
You can't win big elections if you don't stand for anything. That is totally true. Now, we thought that this election would be, or you should penalize. I should get the buzzer every time I say something like that. Democrats thought that that they would be safe making this election another referendum on Donald Trump. And it turned out that was not good enough. And, you know, I could have told you that long. Well, people were saying that long ago. You need more than that. You need something to stand on. And like I just said, they chose the one guy on that stage, Joe Biden, who really did not have any issue except for status quo ante. The other thing is, you know, they complain, the Democratic centrists are complained about Republicans calling them socialist. It's like, I mean, they've been doing that since forever. I mean, they called Harry Truman that back in 1948. You know, they called Franklin Roosevelt that. If you're a Democrat, you need to figure that out, that that's what they're going to call you. And, you know,
and have something to say in response, because it really stuck, it really did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you can't figure your way out of that one, then you really probably shouldn't be in politics.
Thomas Frank is a longtime political analyst, historian, and author of many books. His latest is The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism. He is the founder of The Baffler magazine, and they are still going strong. Thomas, thank you so much for joining us.
Rose, it was my pleasure.
Thank you. And you can find more information about Thomas's work, read his latest pieces for The Guardian at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. You can find out more about the show and listen to past shows at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.